In the matter of Antonio Nieves versus the Office of the Public Defender, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon. For the plaintiff, appellant, Antonio Nieves, Thomas D. Flynn, Garrity Graham, Murphy Garofalo, and Flynn.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Daniel Vanello, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of respondents.
George Conk for the New Jersey State Bar Association.
Good afternoon, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Flynn, please go ahead.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Radner, Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court. More than 30 years ago, in fact, almost 31 years to the day, Judge Villanueva, sitting as a law division judge in Hudson County, decided the case of Delbridge against the Office of Public Defender. That case was affirmed by the appellate division under another name, AD against Franco, in 1993. There, the appellate division said the actions under three docket numbers, respectively, Joseph Apicella, an attorney assigned by the Office of Public Defender to represent the father in Dyfus's initial proceeding, Joseph Cantaldi, similarly assigned to represent the mother, and Thomas Hartley, the law guardian appointed for the children. Judge Villanueva's opinion explaining his reasons for dismissing the complaints against these defendants is reported at 238 NJ Super. We affirm substantially for the reasons so stated. Judge Villanueva's decision has been followed in this state, in the federal courts as well, and throughout the United States. And his decision is in three parts, essentially three parts. In the first part, Judge Villanueva held that the law guardian, Thomas Hartley, and the Office of Public Defender were absolutely immune from claims by the parents and by the children made for them by the parents. He held further that Mr. Apicella and Mr. Cantaldi, who were assigned to represent the indigent parents, had qualified immunity, but not for claims of legal malpractice. And in the third part of the case, Judge Villanueva held that the state owed indemnification to the pool attorneys, Apicella and Cantaldo, under the Tort Claims Act. Those are three separate holdings by Judge Villanueva, and I think there's confusion by the defendants in this case about what exactly that holding was. They're separate and distinct holdings, and one can't be crossed against the other. Defendants cite to the case decided by this court, Rogers against the Cape May County Public Defender, for the proposition that if our reading of Judge Villanueva's decision is correct, then it was overruled by Rogers against Cape May. And respectfully, we think that didn't happen. This court never mentions Delbridge or AD against Franco in its decision in Rogers. It takes as a given that the provisions, the notice provisions of the Tort Claims Act apply. They describe the position of the plaintiff in that case. Rogers argues that the dismissal of the charges on July 25th was the point of exoneration because up until then, he faced conviction. His notice of tort claim was filed within 1 year of that date. The notice was only 10 days late. Defendants who were already aware of the claim suffered no prejudice therefrom, and an extraordinary change in law justified the late notice. It was never raised in the Rogers matter. There is a provision in Judge Villanueva's decision in Delbridge which might suggest that the notice provisions of the Tort Claims Act would have applied to the claims against Cantaldi and Apicella. We don't think so. We think that that discussion of the notice provision under the Tort Claims Act applies to the law guardians part of the case. It's all contained within the first part of his decision, which addressed the law guardian. But in any event, that's not an issue before this court because Mr. Nieves did file a notice of tort claim. It was timely filed. There's no contest to the validity of that claim. So It's important, I think, and it bears repeating, what Judge Villanueva said about the pool attorneys assigned by the Office of the Public Defender to defend the indigent defendants. He said, defendants Apicella and Cantaldi have immunity from suit at common law and under the Tort Claims Act, except for legal malpractice, conspiracy, and other intentional misconduct. He said, once the appointment of a public defender in a given case is made, his public or state function ceases, and thereafter he functions purely as a private attorney concerned with servicing his client. Thus, he ought to be subject to liability for tortious conduct. This court finds that there is qualified immunity except for conspiracy or intentional misconduct or legal malpractice. Once a public defender is assigned to the representation of an indigent defendant, his public function ceases, except as the Supreme Court acknowledged in the Polk County case cited in our papers and in Judge Villanueva's opinion, in the limited sense that he's fulfilling the government's obligation to provide counsel. His duty, however, is not to the government or the people generally. It is to his indigent client. His obligation is adverse to the government and the people by definition. Judge Villanueva and the authorities on which he relied and the courts that have followed him since recognize the undeniable connection between the accountability of an attorney to his client and the quality of representation. The state here suggests that defendants are not suggesting that the standard of care be less for a public defender, but they are clearly arguing that they should be less accountable to their indigent clients than privately retained counsel. Going back to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Griswold, it is clear that an indigent defendant is entitled to no less of a defense than one with means. The public policy of this state is clearly expressed in the Public Defenders Act. The primary duty of all members of staff and of others engaged on a case basis shall be to the individual defendant, with like effect and to the same purpose as though privately engaged by him, and without regard to the use of public funds to provide the service. That's consistent with Judge Villanueva's decision. The obligation of the assigned public defender is to the client. He is adverse to the interests of the state. It doesn't further the interests of the state interest in immunity to dislodge that that concept.
Do you claim that they're not state employees?
I don't suggest that, Your Honor. What I suggest is that they're different. The interest of the Tort Claims Act is to prevent is in furthering the recognition that state employees owe an obligation to all of the people of the state, and their obligations, if held to scrutiny for torts, would be all-encompassing.
So to public defenders, it's a different obligation. Okay, they're given an obligation by the state to represent criminal defendants, right?
Yes.
That's an obligation of great importance.
Of course.
Of constitutional importance.
Of course.
Why is that obligation different from any other state employee? Everyone has appointed tasks. The attorney general, the county prosecutor, the police, sanitation. This is just another task assigned by the state to fulfill the constitutional responsibility that the state owes to indigent defendants.
The difference, Your Honor, is that all of those other state employees are working to further the interests of the state.
They're doing that here.
And all
the state has an obligation of ensuring that the defendant receives a fair trial. That cannot happen without an attorney representing the indigent defendant, correct?
That's true. And that's what the Supreme Court of the United States agreed in Polk, but said that the attorney representing the indigent defendant is performing a state function only in that limited sense. His overriding obligation is to the indigent defendant.
But nonetheless, it's still a state function, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
Nonetheless, it's still a state function, whether it's as to the individual defendant or as to all citizens. That public defender is providing a state function to the public by representing indigent people to uphold our main constitutional mandates.
As the U.S. Supreme Court said in Polk County,
but you can't,
to that limited extent.
I don't think you can fairly compare 1983 cases to our Tort Claims Immunity Act. Because
They're talking about state actors under the Constitution. We have a statute. Whatever it says, it says. So the question is, the public defender a state employee?
I don't know that it's that simple, Your Honor, because Judge Villanueva decided this in 1989.
Was Judge Villanueva serving as a Superior Court Judge, Law Division?
Yes.
Are we bound to follow a case by a Law Division judge?
Of course not.
And the Villanueva case, was it dealing with an appointed counsel rather than a public defender?
A pool counsel.
Yes. So that's another distinction. A person who is typically a private attorney, but on an assigned basis, is doing public defender work. So that may be questionable whether or not the person is a state employee, but the public defender here is a full-time state employee, correct?
Yes.
Well, that's a big distinction, no?
Respectfully, I think it's not a big distinction because the third part of Judge Villanueva's decision is that the state is responsible for the legal malpractice of the pool attorney's malpractice. That's the third part of his decision where he says the Tort Claims Act makes the state liable to indemnify that pool attorney.
If Villanueva's decision never existed, what is your best argument? Put aside
that,
whatever he said.
That these concepts cannot be separated from the issue of equal justice under the law. My best argument on the issue of immunity under Section 9-2D of the Tort Claims Act is that these concepts can't be separated from the concept of equal justice under the law. If Mr. Nieves had been represented by a private attorney, he would have brought his case through trial already and received a verdict. He wouldn't have the impediment of having to prove $3,600 in medical expenses.
So look, you have private bus companies and you have public bus companies. You have New Jersey Transit. Okay, if someone's hit by a New Jersey Transit bus, they have to comply with the Tort Claims Act. Yes.
Yes.
If they're hit by a private bus, they don't have to. How is this any different?
It's different because the interest in equal justice under the law is implicated here. It's only because Mr. Nieves was indigent and is guaranteed to the right to counsel that he's in this position of having to show $3,600 in medical expenses.
So isn't your argument with the legislature? I mean, we have a very broad definition of public employee, a very broad definition of public agencies. I have yet to hear an argument as to why the OPD and the individual are not within those broad definitions.
Well, Judge Villanueva, this decision is 31 years old. The appellate division affirmed it 29 years ago. The legislature has done nothing to address if the concept is that the legislature intended to immunize public defenders from legal malpractice claims, they would have taken that up in the interceding 31 years.
You make the same argument about Rogers. You're saying Rogers, you disagree with the application of Rogers, you could say, the legislature hasn't acted to undo Rogers and point out that it really favors Judge Villanueva's decision. Legislative inaction is a pretty thin reed to make a determination. Wouldn't you agree?
It's been 31 years, Your Honor.
31 years with a law division, non-binding, non-precedential decision.
It's an appellate division decision as well. That is not,
it's a,
again,
unpublished,
not binding upon this
unpublished
court.
Appellate division decision, correct?
A.D. Franco was not published. I thought it was wrong.
Yeah, I'm wrong about that. You're saying that his decision was affirmed in a published decision by the appellate division?
Yes, 297 NJ Super 1, appellate division, 1993. If I may move on, We're here because the argument of the state is that because Mr. Nieves can't show $3,600 in medical bills, his claim is barred by Section 9-2D. We submit that he has damages other than pain and suffering, that even if the court is inclined to overrule Delbridge, that he has damages other than pain and suffering. Section 9-2D applies only to pain and suffering. This state allows damages for other categories of losses, including loss of the quality of life. And this court in Ayers against Jackson Township said that loss of quality of life is not pain and suffering for purposes of Section 9-2D.
But that was a property damage.
What kind of a case was there?
It was a contamination and an environmental case that caused the loss of quality of life was that it caused the residents of this community to carry water into their homes, and that was a deprivation of or diminishment of the quality of life.
Are there cases that you can cite to us as a source for quality of life damages in a legal malpractice case?
I cannot, but the general charge, the model jury charge 8.11E, provides specifically for loss of quality of life as a separate element of damages in tort cases.
Also, we have loss of enjoyment of life.
Yes.
Which is an element of damages, different, separate from pain and suffering.
Exactly.
You relying on that?
Yes. Yes. If Mr. Nieves had been represented by private counsel, he would have tried his case, the jury would have been instructed on model jury charge 8.11E, and the jury would have been asked to consider loss of enjoyment of life.
Our courts have recognized loss of enjoyment of life in cases where a person was rendered comatose and therefore incapable of experiencing pain and suffering, and yet that has been submitted to a jury as a point of compensation. So are you arguing that loss of enjoyment of life is a separate category of damages that would be applicable here?
Yes. Yes. And the state argues that there is no such thing in a legal malpractice case because false arrest, malicious prosecution cases have wrapped up those types of damages into emotional distress. You know, the incarceration associated with that is emotional distress. I submit that's a completely separate
and
apart.
Life is something different. It's the things that you would have experienced outside the prison walls had you not been wrongly incarcerated.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, and I'm going to have you can comment on this, that this type of damages would be applicable in any wrongful arrest case. It just so happens that this, where this is coming up to us in the form of a legal malpractice case. But whatever we say in this legal malpractice case will apply to every wrongful arrest case that is brought in this case. And if this court does not recognize a form of damages for loss of liberty, a loss of enjoyment of life, then a person who is wrongly arrested in many cases will not have any means of being compensated at all.
That's exactly what Mr. Nieves faces.
Is that not an end run around the Tort Claims Act limitation on what can be collected against the state?
Well, Your Honor, Section 9.2 says pain and suffering, and this is different from pain and suffering. We're not talking about removing pain and suffering from the case, removes from the case the anger, the rage, the frustration that Mr. Nieves would have experienced from the day he was found guilty by the jury, from the day that the trial court imposed a life sentence upon him, through every single day that he woke up
behind bars.
And
the legislature has responded with a statute that provides a per diem amount for each day of wrongful imprisonment.
That's true. But that remedy is available whether there's legal malpractice or not, whether there's been a deprivation of civil rights or not. It's available whether or not the defendant was represented privately or
Doesn't that suggest
a public
that was
defender.
Meant to be the only remedy then?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't that suggest to you that that was meant to be the only remedy for wrongful incarceration?
No, absolutely not. If Mr. Nieves had been represented by private counsel, he'd have his legal malpractice case. He'd have his availability to emotional distress damages. He'd have his
But that would be against private counsel. That would not be against the state.
True.
Doesn't that statute suggest to you that the only damage the state is required to satisfy are those in that statute for the per diem?
I don't.
And nothing else?
Respectfully, Judge,
I don't see anything else that says otherwise anywhere.
I don't see anything that connects the two. I don't see anything that connects the Mistaken Imprisonment Act, which is available to anyone who's mistakenly imprisoned
right.
with certain exceptions, and provides
only for economic damages.
Provides a specific type of compensation, specifically replacement economic damages. It's to replace lost wages with a minimum of $50,000 per year or a multiple of the actual lost wages.
And you have to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. And this state has recognized wrongful arrest as a tortious claim for hundreds of years. And that's a much higher standard than a wrongful arrest.
Yes.
But it's still limited to that amount, that per diem amount.
For in a mistaken imprisonment case.
For any type of, yes, mistaken imprisonment.
Limited to that amount, yes. To the amount of $50,000 per year, as I recall it, $50,000 per year, or a multiple of the actual lost earnings that can be proved. I can't remember what
so the multiple if, is. So under that act, the wealthier you are, the greater the return you're going to get. But the question that you're facing with your client, because you apparently got the minimum, is whether or not the poorest person who happens to be wrongly incarcerated and suffers loss of enjoyment of life or loss of liberty is entitled to the same remuneration as the wealthiest person in this country.
Exactly.
I don't think it's about class or who's more worthy or less wealthy. It's whether it's applicable or not under the statute, and then it's not. And there's nothing to say to the contrary that you're entitled to anything beyond that.
I respectfully disagree. There are a lot of legal malpractice cases here and throughout the country that stand for the proposition that when an attorney is negligent, his wronged client is entitled to the full measure of damages caused by that negligence.
And under the Restatement of Torts that talks about torts by attorneys, law governing lawyers, when it drills down on that, it talks about emotional distress damages. Where are the damages that you're talking about being recognized?
I have not been able to find a case.
Neither could I.
That says that the type of damages that I'm advocating for here, loss of quality of life damages, are not available.
Well, the loss of quality of life is a known concept that comes up and is discussed in the Restatement of Torts dealing with nuisance claims, property damage, which has its own way of calculating damages for the loss of use of property. And discomfort and annoyance to a person as the occupant is one of the forms of special damages you can get under the law of nuisance in that property context. I've been unable to find any translation of that concept into the setting in which you are asking it to be imported here. And in fact, to the contrary, with the restatement of the law governing lawyers, it suggests that it's not there. Emotional distress damages are, as I mentioned, but not this new sliver of categories that you are arguing for.
What I'm arguing for, Your Honor, is that New Jersey recognizes, even in the general damages model jury charge, that loss of enjoyment of life is a damage that a jury may consider and compensate.
In the context of a malpractice action.
In the context of any tort action.
This is just, tell me if I'm mistaken, maybe I'm missing something. This is a wrongful arrest case that is wrapped up in a malpractice case. And it doesn't seem to me that your client should be disentitled or disadvantaged by not having the same form of damages that would be possible in a wrongful arrest case. It just happens in this unique case. It's an attorney malpractice case. There aren't a lot of attorney malpractice cases dealing with imprisoned people. And that's the reason why I think the case law is skewed in other directions. This is a unique type of case.
I think Your Honor is exactly right. The cases focus on whether or not emotional distress damages are available in legal malpractice, and the majority of them that hold that they are in cases where there is a loss of liberty, it should be presumed that when one loses his liberty under these circumstances, that there is going to be emotional distress suffered.
Let's go back to basics.
Yes.
This is not a wrongful arrest case, is it?
Right. No.
It isn't. There's no allegation in your complaint about wrongful arrest.
No.
This is an allegation that the individual who represented your client didn't do something he should have done in order to meet the standard of care.
A number of things.
Right, number of things, and I appreciate that. I understand what they are. This is a legal malpractice case, nothing more and nothing less, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, and I don't find anything in the cases except for, I think, a New York case cited by the defendants that says that there's not to be compensation for one who's imprisoned as a result of his attorney's negligence.
So, if a person is entitled in a wrongful arrest case, we'll just assume this, that he or she is entitled as an element of damages, loss of enjoyment of life or liberty, for being wrongly incarcerated. What would be the difference if the person is wrongly incarcerated because of attorney's malpractice in terms of setting the damages? I'm asking you that question. Your adversaries can.
I don't have the answer. I don't have the answer to that, Your Honor, because my adversaries cite those same false arrest cases for the proposition that I'm only entitled to emotional distress damages, and because I can't meet the $3,600 threshold, I'm essentially entitled to nothing, and that I think would result in a miscarriage of justice. It defies the concept of equal justice under the law. If an indigent criminal defendant cannot look to his attorney for having caused his 12 and a half years of imprisonment, while he could if he had had the means to retain his own counsel privately.
So let me ask the last question. Having raised this issue of loss of enjoyment of life and liberty as a potential means of recovery, tell me what limiting principle there would be. Like, how would a jury calculate loss of enjoyment of life, all the things that the person didn't experience as a result of being incarcerated for 12 years?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think in the same way they make any determination of unliquidated damages. This is...
Does New Jersey allow hedonic damages as a measure of damages?
I think that's what the charge is, Judge. I think that's what...
That's, I think not that, allowed in New Jersey.
I think that's
damages.
what the model
jury... Are you talking about 811?
811. 811E.
811 does not allow hedonic damages.
If I may read from it,
Sure.
The law in compensation recognized that a plaintiff may recover for any disability or impairment that he or she suffers as a result of his or her injuries. Disability or impairment means worsening, weakening, or loss of faculties, health, or ability to participate in activities. And, of course, the jury's guidance in how to make that determination of what dollar amount should be imposed to that is left to their good judgment and common sense. The law also permits a plaintiff to recover for the loss of enjoyment of life, which means the inability to pursue one's normal pleasure and enjoyment. That's exactly what I'm arguing for here. Mr. Nieves suffered the loss of the enjoyment of his life for 12 and a half years while he sat in a jail cell instead of, fishing at the waterfront in Perth Amboy or doing anything else that anyone in his position or any of our positions might have enjoyed during that 12 and a half year period. And what a jury is instructed to do, I believe, in order to put a value on that loss is to bring to bear their good judgment and common sense.
Oh, they always bring a good judgment. There's no better measure to charge Sheldon than their own common sense and knowledge. There's no strict formula. I understand that.
Yes.
It's still not hedonic. Okay, go ahead.
Your argument is that loss of life's pleasures is different than pain and suffering in the ordinary malpractice case.
Yes. In any tort case.
Well, particularly legal malpractice. Because wouldn't you agree that in a typical legal malpractice case, pain and suffering is not an element of damages?
Yes. Okay. Yes, in the overwhelming majority of cases involving legal malpractice, it's an economic question. You know, when the negligent attorney loses the medical malpractice case, well, the attorney's not responsible for the pain and suffering of his client as a result of the malpractice. He's charged with the loss of the value of that medical malpractice.
So your argument then that somehow, or Justice Albin, somehow a person who can afford private counsel and sues that private defense attorney for malpractice because he ended up getting convicted, later overturned by DNA, somehow is in a different position than this defendant, is not correct, because any defendant wrongfully convicted could bring a legal malpractice action against their private counsel or their public defender for loss of liberty damages, different than pain and suffering. So there is no difference between the private defendant, the private attorney for the defendant who has money, and the public defender who represents the indigent defendant.
If this court assessed my position with respect to the loss of enjoyment of life damages not being barred by Section 92D, I agree. Then the only difference is that the indigent defendant who sues his public defender for malpractice only loses the pain and suffering, the subjective and arguably trivial aspect of his pain and suffering, because you can't meet that $3,600 threshold.
But in the instance of forgetting that issue, for legal malpractice by a wealthy defendant in a criminal matter later exonerated, the remedy on damages would essentially be the same as except for the verbal threshold question, as for the indigent defendant.
Yes, except for the verbal threshold question. And, you know, there are certainly conceivable cases where an indigent defendant will suffer $3,600 in medical bills,
because
will have a permanent type of permanent injury that can get past Section 92D. Mr. Nieves can't, notwithstanding the fact that he spent 2.5 years in prison.
If he had sought out upon his release medical care and treatment, as he would if he'd been physically injured, but psychologically injured in this case, he might meet the verbal threshold.
He might have.
But he did not do that.
He didn't.
Counsel, I have one last question, at least from my perspective. When you were talking about the continued vitality of the Delbridge case, and you talked about Rogers, you felt Rogers did not address the government function consideration, that it was just assuming that the Tort Claims Act would apply. Are you familiar with a case called Stomel versus City of Camden?
It's not ringing any bell to me.
Okay, it was a SEPA action that was a 1983 setting, and it dealt with a municipal public defender for the City of Camden being removed because of actions that he had taken. And one of the arguments that was made in that case was that because he was a municipal public defender, he was not an employee of the executive branch of the City of Camden. And the court rejected that, said that the municipal public defender function was a required obligation of the city, of the executive function. And therefore, it was a statute that required that, not all that different from what we have here, a constitutional obligation to provide representation to indigent defendants in a criminal setting. We said that function remained an executive function, and it had to be regarded as one in which the person filling it, even on a part-time basis, by contract, was an employee. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that undercut the argument that we saw continued vitality in Delbridge, even though we didn't feel the need to confront Delbridge, either in Rogers or in Stomel?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor, because even Judge Villanueva recognized qualified immunity for public defenders. No one suggests, and Judge Villanueva didn't suggest, that they're not public employees entitled to indemnification under the Tort Claims Act. They're not immune from legal malpractice claims.
But he said that only because of his own interpretation of what he thought should apply. He didn't do a statutory analysis, did he?
That That may be true. There was not a discussion by Judge Villanueva about the precise language within the statute.
But in Judge Villanueva's setting, he was dealing with the required appointment of parents in family termination matters, as I recall,
yes.
Correct? And you have a statute requiring the law guardian to make sure that there's an appointment of representation for parents in those settings if they can't afford one. To me, it's hard to not view that as a required governmental function, which seems to meet the definition of public employee, public entity, performing under 59(1)-2 the very broad responsibilities that the Tort Claims Act recognizes is the responsibility of government.
I'm not here to contest that the public defender is not a state employee. He is. But when he's performing a function that exposes his client to imprisonment due to his negligence, he is that particular client's attorney.
So what happens with a doctor? A doctor who is employed by a state institution,
right.
The doctor is treating all of the characteristics of an attorney client, of a physician patient relationship exist, confidentiality and all of those obligations, the duty of loyalty of a doctor to his or her patient, and yet that state employee doctor, if that state employee doctor is sued for medical malpractice, is subject to the TCA, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So both are important relationships. We have a state bar here. Obviously, an attorney-client relationship is a very important one. So is the physician-patient relationship. Both of those individuals are working for the state because it is a state duty, constitutional in the lawyer instance, not constitutional in the medical, but a state duty to provide the care or the services that are needed for the individual who's in the state institution. Or is the indigent defendant? Why should lawyers be treated any differently than doctors?
Because of the adversity between the indigent client and the state, and the public defender's obligation to that client, as opposed to the state.
The state doctor may testify on behalf of the institutionalized. Individual in a hearing on civil commitment, for example. There may be an adversity of sorts between the state and that doctor. The doctor's not always cheerleading for the state.
And there are numerous situations where lawyers on behalf of, say, the Division on Civil Rights will take an action on behalf of a private citizen and sue an employee and agency of state government. And there's adverseness between the attorney representing DCR and the individual who's claiming discrimination and the attorney who's representing the state employee and agency who's charged with engaging in an act of discrimination. So we have that, and yet you're suggesting that those people should be stripped of their right to a defense and indemnification if there's a tort claim later filed?
I do not suggest that. I agree with Judge Villanueva's third part of his decision that says that they are entitled to a defense and indemnification because they are state employees. But the nature of the relationship between the attorney for the indigent defendant and any other attorney employed by the state is substantively different. And I would call to the court's attention the case of Polk County, the U.S. Supreme Court case of Polk County. Counsel suggested in their supplemental brief that, well, we had other remedies. We could have brought a civil rights action. You cannot bring a civil rights action against an attorney. It's conceivable you could bring a civil rights action against a doctor. You cannot bring a civil rights action against an attorney because the U.S. Supreme Court said in Polk County, he's not a state actor. His obligation is to the client. He is not acting on behalf of the state. And Judge Villanueva cited to that case. It's perfectly consistent with the argument that I'm making here, which is that the goals advanced by the Tort Claims Act simply don't apply. to this particular setting of an assigned attorney representing an indigent.
Where in the statute? We're dealing with a statute, and I think you would agree that our goal, I mean, our task here is to interpret the TCA.
Yes.
Right. Nothing more, nothing less. We're not here to comment on whether it's good or bad policy. Where in the statute do we see legislative intent that there be an exception for legal malpractice claims?
I don't see it, Your Honor. And I don't know that it was ever considered at the time of the initial drafting, but neither has it been amended to address this issue, which has not been a quiet issue.
I mean, but the clear intent of the legislature, I think you'd have to agree, is that immunity is the rule and liability is the exception, and that where they have specific exceptions to liability, they tell us. That's a fair statement about the TCA.
Immunity is the rule, liability is the exception. And if we were talking about a public defender who ran through an intersection on his way to court, he would have the benefit of that tort claims immunity. I'm simply suggesting that because he owes an obligation to his client that's opposed to the state's interest in either achieving justice in a particular criminal case or obtaining a conviction in a particular criminal case, that interest of that criminal defense attorney is different.
But you can't cite to us, and I understand, you know, you're being candid about the statute, you can't cite to us any legislative intent that for lawyers, for doctors, for any situation where there's potential adversity to the state, as Justice Lobachie pointed out in terms of a deputy AG who's representing civil rights cases, all the situations where there's some adversity to the state, all bets are off. That's not in the statute, is it?
I do not see it in the statute. I don't see that the legislature ever considered individual particular classes of state employees as opposed to other classes of state employees either before or after.
So shouldn't we assume that they want everyone to be treated the same in terms of the TCA? If they didn't make exceptions, how can we decide, well, we think there's something, some relationships operating here that are different and we're just going to take it out of the statute? How can we do that?
I cited in my petition, Your Honor, cases that stand for the proposition that when a court interprets a statute and the legislature does nothing to correct or otherwise speak to that court's interpretation of the statute, that it agrees with the court's interpretation.
I think we have your position on this. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bruno.
May it please the court, we submit that the court has three questions to answer, and at least two of them should be very simple. First, before it decides whether non-economic loss resulting from incarceration is or is not subject to the verbal threshold, what it first needs to decide is whether this state should recognize such damages at all for legal malpractice claims. Now, as we set forth in our brief, there is basis to do so here, though for consistency and as a matter of sound policy, it might be limited to egregious and extraordinary circumstances like those our courts have identified in family court matters, and also as the federal courts have predicted. If non-economic damages will be available, the answer to the other question should be simple. If it's asserted against public employees, it must be subject to the Tort Claims Act, including the verbal threshold. The verbal threshold is intended to apply to any and all types of non-economic loss. The comment to NJSA 59:9-2D says that it is meant to apply to any and all non-economic loss, such as pain and suffering. And this court has recognized the same in the Beauchamp versus Amadeo case from 2000, and just in the last term in the O'Donnell versus NJ Turnpike Authority case. Case after case has reaffirmed that the verbal threshold does apply specifically to pain and suffering damages, which includes emotional distress. And that is what loss of liberty represents. That is what every other state that has addressed this issue regards loss of liberty to be, and that is what the restatement of the law calls it. If loss of liberty damages were available here, plaintiff needed to meet the verbal threshold, and as he conceded, he does not. He conceded he has no economic loss That issue was resolved on the summary judgment stage. He's proceeding now under the claim that he should recover some sort of non-economic loss. The final question for this court should be the simplest of all to answer. Is the tort of legal malpractice subject to the Tort Claims Act at all? It is. In fact, this court and all other courts of the state have repeatedly held that it is. Plaintiff would have this court take a 180 turn from decades of jurisprudence. The only way it could do so now is if it holds that public defenders cannot be considered state public employees when they are acting in representation of a client. But that is the very thing the state pays them to do and what the state created and funds the public defender's office to do. That is the only and the dispositive fact. That is what determines that they are, in fact, state public employees and not which particular members of the public they happen to serve. I also want to bring to this court's attention a statute that I neglected to cite in my brief, but it should consider, and that's Title 52:27E-57, which makes expressly clear that the Tort Claims Fund, the fund created by the legislature to indemnify the state and state employees under the Tort Claims Act, shall be available to pool attorneys if they are sued by their indigent clients. It goes without saying that staff attorneys would also be indemnified. I want to address Delbridge, excuse me. Plaintiff's analysis, respectfully, is incomplete. He keeps citing to three holdings that Judge Villanueva made. He made more than three holdings. We have a law guardian, and we had pool attorneys who were representing the indigent parents in a child custody matter. What Judge Villanueva held is that federal law provides absolute immunity to Mr. Hartley, the law guardian, because he has absolute judicial immunity. If that is all he needed to hold, as the plaintiff says, then he did not need to reach the next holding made, which is that Mr. Hartley is also immune under state law by virtue of the Tort Claims Act, 59:3-2, discretionary immunity. The absolute immunity provided by federal law has no bearing on state law, and that is why the judge needed to make the holding that he did. Similarly, when he held that the Office of the Public Defender is an arm of the state and has sovereign immunity under the 11th Amendment and is not a person subject to suit under 1983, he then had to make the additional holding that the Public Defender's Office would also be immune under the Tort Claims Act, which he did. The point being, federal law and state law are apples and oranges, and plaintiff is trying to conflate the two. Just because someone is immune under federal law doesn't mean that they're immune under state law, and the inverse holds as well. That's why the state can be subject to suit under the Tort Claims Act, even though it has sovereign immunity for all intents and purposes under federal law. For this court to hold otherwise now would not just be bad law, but bad policy as well. Among other things, it would deprive hundreds of public defenders of the guarantee of state defense and indemnification if and when they should ever be sued for malpractice or for anything else they do in their representation of clients. A plaintiff's counsel distinguishes representation from driving to court. But if a public defender is driving to court in furtherance of his or her representation of the client, why would they be subject to the Tort Claims Act protections or defense indemnification if they're not for the alleged malpractice that they may commit on behalf of their clients? This would be a potentially devastating policy change in and of itself. In fact, the policy considerations weigh so much in the other direction that some other states have gone so far as to grant their public defenders absolute immunity from legal malpractice. We do not ask for that change here. We just ask to keep the status quo. We ask that the appellate division's judgment be affirmed in full. At this point, I'll be happy to answer any questions Your Honors may have.
You heard my series of questions concerning imprisonment, because we recognize the tort of wrongful arrest, correct? Wrongful,
yes.
Imprisonment. So that many times happens through false arrest by police officers. Do you agree that whatever we say in terms of damages in this case will also apply in those cases as well? Or do you make a distinction?
I agree with that, Your Honor, in that it almost doesn't, in a sense, with regard to the damages issue, it doesn't really matter what the tort is that we're dealing with here. In this case, it is legal malpractice.
Precisely.
It could have been a wrongful arrest.
So let's take a wrongful arrest. Someone is wrongly arrested, there's no probable cause, and they serve 60 days in jail. They're not beat up, they don't have any medical injuries, or they haven't suffered any permanent psychological damages. Any element of damages whatsoever, other than if they were employed, 60 days of lost pay?
They would, under that scenario, they would have no non-economic loss. They would only have economic loss, such as lost pay,
okay,
if that's available.
Okay, so you use the term non-economic, but that is not the language that is in 5992, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The language in the statute itself
pain
refers
suffering.
To pain and suffering.
And the legislature has used the term non-economic in other circumstances. For instance, in our no-fault tort law, the term non-economic is used, correct?
Correct.
Can we assume that the legislature understands that the difference between using the term non-economic in one context and a more narrow reading of pain and suffering in another?
Not only can this court do so, it has done so. As I indicated in the Beauchamp and the O'Donnell opinions, this court, in discussing 59:9-2, has stated that it is meant to apply to any and all non-economic loss. And the task force comment to the statute says the same. And as this court is aware, the task force comments have the force and effect of legislative history.
But it can't override the language in the statute. I mean, the statute says pain and suffering. I mean, if the legislature wanted to use the term non-economic, it could have used that.
It could have.
Correct? So why shouldn't we keep the legislature to the language in the statute? It says no limitation of recovery for pain and suffering. Why should we extend that to a case, whether it's legal malpractice or wrongful arrest, where a person suffers a loss of liberty and therefore a loss of enjoyment of life? Like why should we weed that out when the legislature has narrowed the field here to pain and suffering?
Well, aside from what I said before, where this court has done just that, you have to look at and consider the reasons why there's a verbal threshold in the first place. And it wasn't just to limit pain and suffering damages. It was to limit any sort of damages that are not calculable in the way that economic damages are.
Look what we did in Ayers' new case. Pain and suffering, quality of life. Yes, it was a different type of tort, but this court recognized that a group of people suffered. It wasn't pain and suffering. It fell into a different category of damages, quality of life, and it was recognized. Yes, it was recognized in a nuisance case. Why shouldn't we be recognizing in a case involving a wrongful, let's say, wrongful arrest or a malpractice where a person should not have been imprisoned, that the person suffered a loss of enjoyment of life, quality of life, whatever you want to call it, or liberty? Why shouldn't we recognize it just the way we recognized it in Ayers?
In Ayers, this court identified the quality of life as a property interest and as an objective loss, and that's why it was able to distinguish quality of life damages from emotional distress in the very same opinion.
And Ayers was a nuisance case. Nuisance is an ancient cause of action, common law cause of action. And it has traditionally focused on exactly that type of damages. Isn't that a fair statement about Ayers?
That's correct, Your Honor. In Ayers, the court, in finding that quality of life damages are available, they were relying on the restatement of the law and as among other authorities. With regard to legal malpractice, of the states that have recognized any sort of non-economic loss, anything other than economic damages, and there's been very few, and some states, such as New York, have said, we're not going to permit it. They've only recognized it in the form of emotional distress.
You know, wrongful arrest is a couple hundred years old. I don't know if it's as ancient as nuisance, but it goes pretty back. It goes pretty far back. Would you agree?
I would. But this isn't a wrongful arrest case, and this is a claim of legal malpractice. And there are good policy reasons why courts have not permitted emotional distress in any sort of legal malpractice case, not just those
Is there any reason why this court in this legal malpractice case would have to make pronouncements that apply to wrongful arrest cases?
It would not, because this isn't about whether plaintiff has or hasn't stated a claim of legal malpractice. We didn't challenge that up to this point.
And there's no wrongful arrest. Obviously, all the considerations that would exist in that case are not in this case, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, Mr. Nieves, plaintiff keeps misstating respectfully our argument. We're not saying that he could have sued Mr. Adolf for a civil rights violation. I'm talking about the police officers, the prosecutors who were involved in his arrest and prosecution. Some of the defendants may have different immunities. But
are you suggesting that in a wrongful arrest case we can consider liberty and loss of enjoyment life as an element of damages?
I believe this court said that in Dela Cruz it is something that could be considered, but as in Dela Cruz, what we're arguing here is if you're suing a public employee, you need to meet the verbal threshold.
But I'm dealing with, in most wrongful arrest cases, we're dealing with a police officer. I want to see if you're distinguishing between wrongful arrest cases and legal malpractice when it comes to the element of damages when a person is wrongly imprisoned. Are you or are you not?
I'm only distinguishing it if for policy reasons this court would not permit non-objective or non-economic loss in a legal malpractice case. And the reasons it would not do so are for reasons other than the non-economic loss is a result of
the nature of loss of enjoyment of life or loss of liberty. What that is, that creature, that species, is not going to change in a legal malpractice case from a wrongful arrest case. Do you agree?
I would agree with that. The value of the damages would be the same. The issue is whether this court should permit it in either of those situations, and if it would for at least one, would it permit it for both?
If refresh my recollection, because it's been a long time since I tried a civil case. Are loss of life's pleasures one of the elements charged to a jury in pain and suffering? Specifically pain and suffering in the jury charge? Maybe your amicus colleague can answer that question. Loss of life's pleasures.
I am admittedly not too familiar with that instruction either, Your Honor.
I thought it was.
But it comes up in the context of someone has lost the use of a limb, for example. The activities that they can no longer become involved with becomes an issue in a personal injury case.
There might be some situations where that is true, and I guess a plaintiff could proceed either as if he has some sort of economic loss or perhaps non-economic loss.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Kahn.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity, judges, to present the concerns of the New Jersey State Bar Association. Our fundamental objectives are to serve the public by protecting the integrity, competence, and vitality of the bar, to help assure citizens access to justice and adequate remedies, and to assist the courts in their mission to guarantee that justice is done. So the court granted certification to answer the two questions. Are legal malpractice claims exempt from the Tort Claims Act? And is plaintiff's loss of liberty damages claim subject to the verbal threshold of the Tort Claims Act? The answer to the first question must be no, in our opinion. Lawyers such as full and part-time public defenders serve the state by whom they are employed. The statutory structure recognizes that. NJSA 2A 158-9, which we cite in our brief, states specifically that the public defender shall divide the case workload of the office between the professional staff and the trial pool or pools. Pool attorneys are are public employees, state employees, as much as staff attorneys are. Having spent 4 years in Newark as a pool attorney, trying the same types of cases, the armed robberies, the drug deals, and the homicide cases as everybody else, we took on the same responsibility and had the support of the Public Defender's Office, including the investigative staff of the Office of the Public Defender, and the financial support if we found it necessary to hire expert witnesses. So whether you're a pool attorney or a full-time staff attorney, you're an employee and a servant of the state. And I note that the definition of employees in the Tort Claims Act refers specifically to full-time, part-time, and even uncompensated servants of the state. So we don't need to distinguish among those categories. So how do they serve the state? Public defenders help to vindicate the constitutional obligations of due process, equal protection, and fair trials. But of course, they may falter and give rise to professional liability claims. Competent criminal defense lawyers should not be deterred from public service. Without the defense and indemnification assured by the Tort Claims Act, the interest of both public defenders and those with just claims against them are ill-served. The Tort Claims Act blocks frivolous claims with its verbal threshold, 5992. It limits certain damages. For example, it grants credits for collateral sources. It bars prejudgment interest. It bars civil punitive damages awards against the state and any other public entity, but it does not cap compensatory damages. The costs of defense are beyond the capacity of staff public defenders and of the typically young freelance pool attorneys. The court also asked if damages for loss of liberty is a compensable element that's distinct from pain and suffering, which ordinarily requires expert medical testimony to establish a significant physical or, in aggravated circumstances, such as sexual assault. The court may recall Collins versus Union County Jail, where the court held that even absent physical injury, that the aggravated circumstances of a sexual assault by a jail guard supported findings of emotional distress damages, which in that case did meet the threshold requirement. But on that issue, we offer no opinion, and so I gave that to my remedy students for a final exam question, but it's beyond.
But they're not watching. They're going to anticipate the exam.
It's beyond the scope of my engagement today. So on the issue of exemptions from liability, defense, and indemnification, it's the court's first question that aroused our concern. Could the answer possibly be yes? And for the reasons that I've stated, we think that the answer must be no, that the Tort Claims Act must apply to public defenders, whether full or part-time. We considered the scope of liability and the sorts of damages to which lawyers performing public service could be subjected. The threshold and liability principles properly block insubstantial claims, and They also assure that a lawyer's reasonable, discretionary, professional judgments that may later be shown to be mistaken provide no basis for liability. So persons charged with crime, of course, are entitled to the effective assistance of counsel as a matter of due process, as part of the right to a fair trial, and public defenders may, like other lawyers, be responsible for negligent or other breaches of professional standards of competence, diligence, and loyalty. We recognize, too, the absence of a cap, and we note that the potential burden for state lawyers for negligence is great if they will not be indemnified as provided by Section 10.1 of the Tort Claims Act. And so, ironically, the effectiveness of the tort remedy would be vitiated if public defenders and pool attorneys are not covered by the Tort Claims Act. We considered, too, that without the benefit of the Tort Claims Act and the promise of defense and indemnification, awards against a government-employed lawyer could include non-dischargeable and uninsurable civil punitive damages. But under the State Tort Claims Act, the state may indemnify a state employee for exemplary or punitive damages. And for that reason, too, the protection of the Tort Claims Act is important to the interest of the courts and of the state itself in assuring the competence and fairness and ability of our courts to achieve correct and just results. Finally, on fee shifting, the liability for legal malpractice involves not only money judgment, but also costs of defense and the former client plaintiff's counsel fees. Under the Saffer versus Willoughby line of cases, which has discomfited the bar for almost 25 years, the plaintiff's costs of prosecution may be recovered as compensatory damages. But the Tort Claims Act protects state-employed lawyers from that burden, whether they're or not they are compensated, so long as they have performed any authorized service to the state. And so in conclusion, although the formal structure of the Tort Claims Act is to declare a default position of immunity, we recall that the act was driven by this court's declaration in Willis versus Department of Conservation in 1970, in April of 1970. And I'm very clear about it being April 1970 because in September 1970, I started law school at the State University of New Jersey. And Professor Fiordalisi assigned us the Prosser casebook, which hadn't yet caught up with the New Jersey Supreme Court. And so one of the first cases that we learned about was Willis versus Department of Conservation, in which this court said, "It is plainly unjust to refuse relief to persons injured by the wrongful conduct of the state. No one seems to defend that refusal as fair. There has been a steady movement away from immunity. And the Tort Claims Act was adopted in response to Willis versus Department of Conservation, and its restitutionary purpose is plainly stated in 59.2-2, liability of a public entity. The Act says a public entity is liable for injury proximately caused by an act or omission of a public employee within the scope of his employment in the same manner and to the same extent as a private individual under like circumstances. And we therefore conclude that the purposes of the Tort Claims Act can be accomplished and access to justice served only by answering question number one, no.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for the very fine arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.